This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up today on the show, we learn about mindfulness in the classroom with elementary teacher Olivia Becker. She visits with Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Ed podcast. But first, being a kid, not always so easy. Fitting in is of utmost importance. And if you don't, other kids, and sometimes even classroom policies, can be challenging. Alex, Not Amy, Growing Up Transgender in the Rural West is a documentary from independent producer Denise Dowling. She is a journalism professor at the University of Montana in Missoula, and she produced this documentary for Montana Public Radio. And in it, she shares the story of 10-year-old Alex O'Neill, who knew since he was a toddler that he's a boy, despite being assigned female at birth. The documentary looks at laws, guidelines, and policies impacting transgender youth.
I almost died.
I thought you were going all the way.
The three O'Neill kids are checking out a new sledding hill. On top of the hill, Karina, 13 years old, and the big sister.
I can make it.
At the bottom, 8-year-old James, the baby brother.
Hey, pip squeak.
And Alex, the 10-year-old middle child, ready for the first run.
But the person that makes it closest to the fence wins.
The O'Neill kids live with their parents in a small town in the Rocky Mountain West, a pretty typical white working class family, with one big exception.
Let's go!
Until just this year, Alex was known as Amy because everyone, even his parents, thought he was a girl.
And I drew a picture of a girl, like an x-ray, and drew the brain and said, girl's body, boy's brain.
An overheard conversation set Alex on a path to legally and socially change his gender identity.
Because they're just like, what? What?
Uncharted territory for Alex, his family, and the rest of his community.
Well, now it's not your daughter anymore. So, you know, that kind of crushes some people's dreams.
Yeah, I'm losing a daughter, but I am gaining a son.
I don't want to be in the middle like a tomboy. I want to be all the way to a boy.
This is his story, Alex, not Amy, and what it was like to become, to the world, the boy he always was inside.
I knew I wanted to be a boy, for real.
Christmas Eve, we're going to make a lot of cookies, so then on Christmas Eve we can watch The Grinch.
10-year-old Alex O'Neill is growing up in the Rocky Mountain West against a backdrop of discrimination.
Right now, but then you hear stories of people who are, you know, bullied and killed and maimed and all this kind of stuff for being transgender.
His parents, Mark and Cheryl O'Neill, worry.
I don't know what the future's going to hold, and I don't want anyone to be able to go out on Google or anything else and use it against them.
It's for those reasons the identity of this family is guarded in this story. According to a study by the Williams Institute at UCLA, here's the reality for transgender people in the United States. 28 transgender people died by homicidal violence in 2017, the most ever recorded. 45% of transgender young adults consider suicide. 78% of transgender kids who experience violence at school attempt suicide. So it was tough for the O'Neills to be optimistic about Alex's future. But let's go back to a time before Alex was Alex.
When we had our first kid, I was about to write a book. Because I thought I was that good of a parent.
A second child came along 2.5 years later. They called the baby Amy.
Kind of a sullen little baby. Didn't really smile very much.
When we had our second kid, he came out with a scowl on his face. And he basically had that for 2 years.
Looking back, Cheryl thinks she saw some clues to the unhappiness watching her kids play.
Always the boy, the groom, the wizard, the husband. So that was kind of pretty big clue.
The O'Neills knew something was up with a child they called Amy. They just weren't sure what.
I never really said he's going to be a boy, but I always sort of thought he would be the boy-like kid.
You're eating all of them? I thought that's why you put them on the plate.
That was not your plate.
The family always refers to Alex as Alex and him. The girl, Amy, never comes up and only does here to make this story easier to understand. For the first years of his life, Alex was treated like a girl by everyone who knew him. And why wouldn't they? He was, from all appearances, female. But when he was just past toddlerhood, he began to rebel.
He started not wanting to wear girls' clothes really early, like maybe 4 or 5 years old. And he never really said that it was because they were girls' clothes, but he'd always have some excuse, like they were too soft or they were too scratchy or, you know, they didn't feel right on his skin. And so so he always kind of got his way as to what things he wanted to wear.
This is the only case I can think of where a child believes themselves to be in a social category that everyone else, at least initially, does not believe they're in.
Dr. Christina Olson at the University of Washington in Seattle is conducting a 20-year study following hundreds of transgender kids and measuring their mental health through puberty and into adulthood. Olson's sample group comprises 3 to 12-year-olds from across the country who have socially transitioned at a very young age.
Kind of between the second birthday and third birthday, the majority of kids will come to very clearly and regularly identify themselves as a particular gender. Now,
the study will measure basic gender development and if and why kids persist or switch back to their natal gender. They'll record the support these young people get from their families, schools, and communities. The study will even look at the impact of location on mental health of transgender youth.
It obviously seems like it would be very hard to be transgender, especially in certain parts of the country.
In the rural West, only 0.3% of adults identify as transgender. But a recent survey by the Williams Institute at UCLA shows a remarkable 27% of California teenagers consider themselves gender nonconforming.
I think it's a hard position for parents to be in, to decide what to do and to have so many people expressing such strong opinions, many of whom have maybe never met a transgender kid.
The children in this study have the support of a parent or guardian who is allowing them to express their gender identity.
You know, is this a good decision? You know, what are the implications for a child's well-being? 41% of adults who are transgender attempt suicide. Is this anything like a solution to that problem?
The early results of Olson's study are positive.
But the fact that they were doing as well as they are doing was pretty surprising to me.
When Olson began her study, she worried about finding 50 willing participants, but she now has nearly 300. Alex is not part of the study, but he does fit the criteria.
People who didn't know us would refer to him as a boy. And we sort of were always correcting them. It was kind of annoying, actually. And then we'd ask him, do you want us to correct them? Or do you want to correct them? You can say I'm a girl. And he'd be like, oh, I guess. Or it doesn't really matter to me. Or, you know. And so then I started changing it to, do you like it when people call you a boy? And he said, I do, kind of.
So Alex started kindergarten, still known as Amy. He dressed like a boy and hung out with the boys at recess, but a problem started for him in the girls' bathroom.
I was, like, wearing boy clothes and stuff, and I would walk in there, and they would kind of be like, I think you're in the wrong bathroom.
So he'd get off the bus and run home as fast as he could so he could go to the bathroom, which I didn't realize either until he told me later that he was not going all day long.
I'm kind of a goody-goody, and I didn't feel like, I felt like that would be breaking a rule since I wasn't really legally a boy.
So the O'Neills asked the principal to make an accommodation.
Because the principal was willing to let him use a different bathroom, but not the boys' bathroom.
The principal suggested Alex use a bathroom in the gym down a long hallway from the other bathrooms.
He still didn't use it regularly because it was out of the way. You know, what little kid wants to miss recess to go to the bathroom?
This is a very real experience we're having, and we need to be prepared to respond appropriately. So,
Mark Thane is the superintendent of public schools in Montana's second largest school district. Montana has the fourth smallest K-12 population in the U.S., but this district has been ahead of the curve on transgender policy.
We will regard students by the gender with which they identify, and utilize the appropriate pronouns.
Thane's district updated its inclusivity policy in 2015, including protections for gender nonconforming students in school and in extracurricular activities.
In the olden days, we might not have had partitions or dividers between urinals, maybe even stools in restrooms, and making sure that we do. Individual shower stalls, those kinds of things.
In 2017, both Montana and South Dakota legislatures considered bills limiting transgender students' rights. Neither passed. And while schools in Montana and other Western states now enjoy local control, Thane says he anticipates some policy challenges under the Trump administration.
And I think that's unfortunate, again, because the students' best interests are what are critical in my mind. And I think the failure to recognize this as a very real need would be a travesty.
When Alex started elementary school, the O'Neills became hyper aware of how often the students were separated by gender.
And when they'd stand up to do their Christmas program, they always, you know, sometimes they'd have the boys on one side and the girls on one side, and he would always be right in the middle. So he'd be on the edge so that he could, you know, scooch himself over to the boy part if he really had to.
In the fall of Alex's second grade year, he made an especially touching plea to his parents.
Begged and begged and begged us to buy him a little suit, pinstripe suit with a little vest for the Christmas program, or holiday program. you know, and he wrote this little heartbreaking letter about why he wanted to, and he was going to pay his own money, why he wanted to buy this little suit that he saw at Walmart. And I said no, because everybody already thinks you're a boy. And then he wrote this little letter about, I'll tell everybody I'm not a boy, and please, please, please let me get it. So we get him this little suit, and he looked, you know, like the best-dressed little boy there.
But Alex was still legally Amy and a girl, and spent the next 2 years uncomfortably walking that gender line.
Well, it all kind of started when my husband and I were talking about someone else we knew that was going to start taking hormones to change their gender or, you know, become more masculine, and he was overhearing us, so he said, oh, you can do that?
Then you could see an epiphany kind of come over him that he realized that's who he was.
I'm like, I want to be a boy, Mom. I don't feel like I'm a girl.
Mark and Cheryl O'Neill's 10-year-old Amy had just told them he wanted to become a boy. A real boy. They asked Alex to write them a letter to put in writing what he was feeling.
I mean, if you could have read that letter that he wrote to us, that was so, he just said he felt so alone and like he was the only person in the world that felt this way. And he always thought he should be a boy, and he didn't understand why he wasn't a boy. And so to know, for him to realize that there were other people that felt that same way, I think was just a huge, huge relief to him.
Mark and Cheryl talked intensely with Alex over the next several days. The family was getting ready for a summer vacation when Alex broke the news to sister Karina and brother James.
Mom says that I might get to be a boy. And I was just like, what? That's like, wow. But then I thought about it and I was like, well, that makes sense. I think of him more as a boy than a girl, so.
And his little brother, who's a couple years younger, he was okay with it too a little bit, but I think his big thing was he used to be the only boy.
Cheryl and Mark told Alex he could try it out and live as a boy the entire vacation. That meant using the men's room and wearing a boy's swimsuit.
I mean, he enjoyed it, embraced it. You could see he was comfortable in his own skin probably for the first time in his life. Which was very neat to see.
Mark and Cheryl knew making a change was the right thing to do for Alex, and they set about deciding on a new name.
And all the names you picked out were from all the TV shows he's watching, you know, all those tween Disney movies, which made me roll my eyes. So I said, you know, I got to name you the first. I get to pick your name, I said. It's just how it is. Your parents get to pick your name, and you have kids, you can pick their names. So, too bad.
Once they decided Amy would now be Alex, they got ready to share the news. They were anxious about the reaction from their family, especially Alex's religious grandparents.
I said, can you call him? Because I didn't really know what to say about it. Like, hey, Grandma, I'm Mom. I want to be a boy now.
According to Mark, the grandparents were perhaps a bit confused, but totally supportive of their now grandson. Then Mark and Cheryl reached out to the parents of Alex's best friends.
Their reaction was kind of like, well, that's not news to us, sort of thing. I mean, I don't really know if they thought he was transgender in that sense. All his friends were boys, first of all. And they treated him as a boy, a friend of their kids, of their sons.
Some of Karina's friends, but not her good friends, had a tough time with it.
She's like, wait, so he's boy now, and he has a boy name, and does boy things. It's like, yeah, pretty much.
Alex's best friend, no big deal.
He really didn't treat me any different. He just was like, okay, yeah, all right. And we're still really good friends.
Alex petitioned a judge and legally changed his name with relative ease. That meant he could change his name on his Social Security card. But in his home state, Alex cannot change his gender on his driver's license nor his birth certificate without a doctor's certification. The doctor must show a patient has had clinical treatment for a gender change and that the change is permanent and complete. Other Western states have different rules about changing gender on legal documents. In Idaho, for example, no change is ever allowed to a birth certificate. In Utah, a gender change can only come by court order, and there is no standard from county to county nor judge to judge. Utah also requires a check of the sex offender registry for anyone petitioning to change their gender.
I mean, this is my soapbox now. Why do we even need to know if someone's a male or a female? Why is that on our driver's license? Why do you, when you fly on the plane, do you have to put male or female? Why, when you sign up application, do you have to put that? Because there's no real reason that anybody should need to know that, except if you're trying to find a mate.
As summer ended, Mark and Cheryl let the elementary school principal, teachers, and counselor know Alex had legally changed his name and had transitioned to being a boy. Alex was the very first declared transgender student at his elementary, and on the first day of fourth grade, a challenge.
She was having the kids sit boy, girl, in the desks, which I didn't even enter my mind that that was going to be a problem. I'm just go sit in a boy spot. But apparently, you know, people who had known him before came up and said, you're not in the right spot. You need to move over. You're a girl. And
a couple of buddies spoke up saying Alex is right where he's supposed to be.
I'm glad that I picked the friends that don't care. Like, they only care about who you are, not what you are.
Classmates slowly got used to Alex being Alex, not Amy. And so did the family.
The kid is the same kid. And acts the same and treats his brother and sister the same. It's just a matter of now we're all calling him he instead of she. I sometimes mess up the name, but they never mess up the name.
But when it became apparent this change was going to stick, Mark found himself a little sad.
Because he was so good in sports, competing as a girl, it blew me away. I like to see that. I had a tomboy, and now I was going to lose that forever.
Yeah, and I said, you never had one. Because we didn't. We never had a little girl. We did when he was a baby. But he was never a little girl.
I guess good for us from that point on. The same kid that came home from the hospital that wouldn't smile and moped around and argued with everything and went against whatever the rest of the family wanted to do was all smiles and just a happy, pretty much happy-go-lucky kid now.
When Alex began living as a boy, there was a remarkable change in him.
Well, because I've started putting myself out there, and I'm just friendly and nice and stuff. So
we've seen him just become much more outgoing and much more confident.
So confident, he won the job of student body president at the start of his fifth grade year.
This is what I said. All right, how we all doing today? Good, good, good. I can't hear you. Good, good. All right, well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, students and staff.
But while Alex was getting himself elected, his mom was trying to find him a doctor. The O'Neills couldn't find anyone in their rural western town with experience with transgender kids.
We are actually her first transgender child patient. So it's not that it's all out there, but she was willing to, do her own research and help us.
One of the O'Neills' first requests for this doctor, learning about and implanting a puberty blocker. Mark supported the medical intervention for Alex after meeting older transgender people.
Kind of see if you transition late in life, it's fairly obvious, and I think, unfortunately, those people are going to be subjected to a lot more harassment.
The hormone blocker is encased in a plastic bar, surgically tucked just under the skin below the armpit. It blocks female hormones, so Alex will not develop breasts nor have a period. There's an equivalent device to block male puberty.
And I think if you transition sooner with the hormone blockers and hormones, it will help them fit into what society thinks.
Now, I may not be as mind-blowing as Albert Einstein or as strong and fast as Michael Phelps.
The mental health of transgender kids is most at risk in these tween years. The onset of puberty can trigger gender dysphoria, extreme distress over the mismatch between the developing body and a young person's sense of his or her own gender.
That's the time that you're most vulnerable, because you're going through so many changes that you don't want to happen, that's when kids get into trouble with depression and suicide and whatnot.
The hormone blocker is coming into more and more common use for transgender kids so they can explore their gender identity before puberty.
I feel like we've had it pretty lucky because we've sort of known all along and we've not had to change too much and everybody's been really supportive. And plus, we have a female to a male, which is always somehow way more accepting than the other way around.
The O'Neills say Alex will probably begin to take testosterone in the next few years and so undergo male puberty. But any decision on surgery of any kind is a long way off.
I don't think that's a decision that we need to make right now, and I don't really know that he appreciates the magnitude of that. It's still your body, so you can still respect it and, not that it's a bad thing and that you want to cut parts off and whatnot, but that, you can still love your body and be transgender.
Thank you. You have been a great, great audience, and I will be here all day.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we have been airing the radio documentary Alex, Not Amy, Growing Up Transgender in the Rural West. And in the final segment, it's sports for Alex. And that's coming up after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is creating a citizen advisory group to help recruit more hunters and anglers. The 15-member council will suggest ways to encourage more people to buy hunting and fishing licenses. DNR recruitment coordinator James Burnham says those license fees help pay for resource management. He says a number of people are choosing outdoor activities other than hunting or fishing. The DNR will accept nominations to serve on that council until June 22nd. Grand Forks Mayor Mike Brown is attending the annual Conference of Mayors this week. Brown is one of 260 mayors from across the country attending the meeting. Brown says in terms of infrastructure, Grand Forks has tackled that issue. Brown gives Grand Forks legislators a lot of credit for helping to get state funding for a new city water treatment plant. He says that will help businesses expand and give all Grand Forks residents better water. And a 5-year-old Detroit Lakes boy is recovering from injuries suffered in an attack by a wild animal in Detroit Lakes. Police Chief Steve Todd says after speaking with a veterinarian and DNR conservation officers, it was concluded the animal was likely a fisher, which resembles a weasel. Detroit Lakes Public Works employees are setting traps in an attempt to catch the fisher. The boy has significant scratches to his face. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are airing the documentary Alex, Not Amy, Growing Up Transgender in the Rural West. It's from independent producer Denise Dowling, and it is a look at the laws, guidelines, and policies impacting transgender youth. Here's the final segment.
Fast eight, right away. Get up. Take your mark. Go.
Alex faced his toughest body issues in the sport he loves.
Event 3, the 100 IM.
All 3 O'Neill kids swim competitively for their local YMCA. Alex competed well for the girls' team last year, but his dad says he was obviously uncomfortable.
He would have his cap and goggles on, and he would always have a robe on, and he would only take it off. Everything was at the last minute.
I didn't feel like I really wanted to go to any more meets if I had to stay swimming on the girls because it just didn't feel like me. I just felt weird.
USA Swimming governs community swim clubs all over the United States, including the Y, where Alex swims.
We believe that kids should be emotionally, physically, and sexually safe in sport.
Director of Safe Sport for USA Swimming, Susan Wessner, works with local chapters with transgender athletes. She says their concerns are usually about 2 things, which events are appropriate and which swimsuit. USA Swimming has a very clear policy. Swimmers are allowed to choose the locker room, uniform, and team that match their gender identity.
And we have mostly had a gratitude from coaches and clubs where there is a family or a transgender athlete who would like to participate, and we're able to say, oh yeah, we have some guidelines for you. Here's
when Alex asked to move to the boys' team, he got immediate support from the coach.
On the boys' team. And all I did was say to the coach, he wants to swim on the boys' team. And she said, okay.
But these inclusive rules aren't the norm, not in school-based nor non-school-based sports around the West, nor in college and Olympic athletics. Karina says when Alex began swimming with the boys' team at the Y, some of their teammates quit coming to practice.
I was really confused. And there are a couple people that took a few months off, and then when they came back, and they called them a she, and so we just had to keep explaining it to them that it was a he now.
But on this day, for the first time in a major meet, Alex lines up with the boys.
I think he's a pretty good athlete, though. I think he can hold his own.
I just can't wait to feel that water just rushing on my back and stuff and my stomach when I get to be on the boys.
Wessner admires young transgender athletes for standing up for themselves in a sport that is so divided along gender lines.
How much these kids must love swimming, and that, you know, we have a shared love for swimming, and that brings us to a shared place to start with.
They were all still, like, supportive, like, good job and good luck and stuff like that, so made me feel good.
In June, the 5th graders at Alex's elementary school welcomed their families for a send-off to middle school and a trip down memory lane. Alex won't be the first transgender student at his middle school, and he says he's looking forward to being Alex and not Alex who used to be Amy. His parents know the teenage years are just ahead with the parenting challenges there, and with Alex, dating will bring some additional concerns.
I think the kids will be fine. I don't know about the parents. You know, how the parents would feel if their kid came home and said, I'm dating so-and-so, he's transgender. They might be happy.
The O'Neills are already talking to 11-year-old Alex about when, how, and if he'll share his status with the people he meets.
We're not worried about the kids. that he deals with. We're more worried about their parents instilling the parents' values on their kids directed at our son.
So far, there have been no issues of Alex being bullied or harassed, but middle school brings new circumstances.
But I do sometimes worry about his safety, so I just want him to make sure he surrounds himself with people that he trusts and that are going to, you know, watch his back.
Alex has his parents, siblings, family, and friends firmly in his corner.
Because he has a lot of close friends right now that are going to go with him to the same middle school. And so then if anyone else is going to be a jerk to them, they're going to stand up for him, and I will compound anybody that's really mean.
His parents have tried to protect him from stories of intolerance and violence against transgender people, but know they can't live their lives in a bubble.
This was never even on my radar. Didn't even know it existed. Now we see it. He's not alone.
At the end of the day, the O'Neills worry about Alex the same way they worry about all three kids.
You want your kid to grow up and be happy and be able to, you know, love somebody and have someone love them back. But I'm not so worried about that anymore because I've seen enough transgender couples that have found each other that I think that that's entirely possible.
The O'Neills have let Alex take the lead in his very personal journey.
He's just, you know, I guess he's fitting right in, and I think that's what he wants to do.
Oh, good times.
We've embraced it and let him know that we embrace it and let him know that we love him. And here's your journey, and we're going to be here with you.
And on this day, surrounded by friends and family who know him well, all is right in Alex's world.
That made me really happy when I knew I could just be a boy.
Reporting from the Rocky Mountain West for Prairie Public Radio, I'm Denise Dowling.
Denise Dowling is a professor of journalism at the University of Montana. Financial support for this project came from the School of Journalism and the University of Montana's Faculty Research Fund, with special thanks to Montana Public Radio.
Thanks, Denise. Coming up on Main Street, teaching kids mindfulness in the classroom.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This summer brings an exciting new series to downtown Jamestown, the Downtown Arts Market. Live entertainment, creative activities for all ages, and an artisan market every Thursday, June through August, from 5 to 9 p.m. in the Hanson Arts Park, downtown Jamestown. All are welcome, and all activities are free. A celebration of the arts and community. More information can be found at www.jamestownarts.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In her 4 years as a grade school teacher in Bismarck, Olivia Becker says she has done a 180 in terms of her teaching philosophy. Becker says she entered the profession with a traditional approach, but soon found herself overwhelmed by curriculum, teaching to standards, and student behavior. Becker says she came to understand that she wasn't happy and that her students weren't particularly enjoying their time either. So she decided to reinvent her teaching style, which now focuses on student choice, an open concept classroom with flexible seating, and practicing yoga and mindfulness. We learn more in this excerpt of the Cutting Ed podcast with host Tom Gerhardt.
Let's walk through a day in second grade.
Fabulous.
How do you start your day with your kids? Let's start there.
Sure. Kids come in, make a lunch choice, kind of just settle in. I don't have a regimen of what they need to be doing. So they could be finishing up a book they're working on, having a conversation with a friend, sharpening a pencil, getting a drink, pretty relaxed. And then we start our day with a morning meeting where the helper of the day leads us in our pledge, our class promise. Then we read our morning message that tells us what we're going to be doing through the day. And then a certain amount of kids share. And then I usually have them do 3 laps in our commons area because they need to get up and move. And then it just goes into our reading time where I talked about kind of exploring what they want to work on. Sometimes we have bigger goals that we want to accomplish. Like right now we're doing this huge project-based learning on mock trial and kind of why are traditions important. So we're going to have a trial in a few weeks where they're going to be having to persuade our school board and our superintendent why we need to have traditions in school and then at home. So we've been working on that lately. And then we'll have snack and sharing, some more sharing time where they have to sign up. So then they're sharing like a book that they read, and then they're getting feedback from other students. Or maybe during that morning time, they worked it out with another teacher where they're going and they're sharing their book with another class. So it just kind of depends what they want to do and where they take that. And then afternoon is our math time, which is going to be on what students need, where they're at. And then, yeah, just kind of depends what we're working on, what we want to hit for the day.
You talked about sending your kids on 3 laps early in the morning, maybe to work off some of that energy.
Yeah.
But you also told me about how important mindfulness is to you. Tell me how you've integrated that into your classroom and how the students have reacted.
So I started at the beginning of the year because I teach 7- and 8-year-olds, and they say you cut their age in half, so they have a 4-minute attention span. And you can see when I'm teaching just how antsy they get. So I teach mindfulness so that they're kind of doing a body scan and they're able to figure out, okay, I'm really agitated right now. I need to do some self-talk. I need to take some belly breaths, or I need to just simply get up and move. I do a lot of playing music and we just take some deep breaths, or I play the chime and we just take deep breaths, and we're just kind of self-aware, kind of how we're feeling in the present moment. And then I've incorporated yoga in our classroom, sometimes before school, and it's amazing the reaction I've gotten, not only from students, but from parents, just the change they've seen in their child and how they just love yoga. And I didn't expect that when I started doing yoga. I practice it, so I thought it would be just something that I could share. I didn't think it would just kind of take off. So I have yoga weeks once a month, and like today a student asked me, when's the next yoga month?
So the students like it. Mm-hmm. What have you noticed in terms of benefits in learning and relationships in the classroom, those types of things?
I think that it holds them accountable in their feelings, where they're able to think like, okay, I had this problem with my friend out at recess. Here are some strategies that I can use to handle this situation instead of maybe yelling at them or saying something hurtful. But then at the same time, if I said these things, which we're human, we all do, this is something that I could do too. We could maybe do, we call it the time machine, where we kind of problem solve as we're stepping together and problem solving. But I think overall, it just, I don't know, maybe it's cheesy, but builds a really calm environment. And it really makes their metacognition, I think, work. Because they're thinking about their thinking, but then they're also thinking about their friends. And kind of being able to put themselves in someone else's shoes.
When you got into teaching, where you are now, totally different place. Talk about that transformation.
I think graduating and getting my first teaching job here in Bismarck Public Schools, I think I was just overwhelmed by the curriculum, all the material that I had to teach, all these standards that I needed to teach. You know, I can't do anything really fun. So I was overwhelmed by that. And I was frankly overwhelmed by all the student behaviors that I was having. They don't teach you that in college, how to deal with that and then also teach XYZ. So it took me some time to understand that I'm not going to be happy, and my students aren't going to be happy if I keep on teaching in this traditional, I need to get through this stuff before the school year ends. So my teaching philosophy has totally done a 180 because I just saw that, you know, I wasn't really happy in it and my students weren't really enjoying their time either.
So you told me you switched to student-led conferences, I think this spring or recently. How has that gone? What have the benefits been that you've noticed, and how have parents reacted?
I don't think I will ever go back to teacher-led conferences because having the students accountable in their learning was amazing to see. Having them share what they know and what they want to know with their parents was just so amazing to watch. I had kind of deliverables that they all needed to have in their portfolio, but what they put in there, how they did it, what they shared was completely up to them. I had one student-led conference that the student chose to read like 5 books to their mom, and it's like you knew that they didn't get that at home, and this was their time when they had 5 adults, you know, in there having their full attention. Only great things from parents that I heard. They liked seeing their child, you know, this is something that we're working on. We're going to solve this math problem right now so that you can see where they're struggling at. And then same with reading. If we're really struggling with reading, we're kind of all in this team together where we're all trying to help your child succeed. And this is now where you see them struggling, but then also succeeding. Students were able to ask any adult that they wanted to come in. So I had grandmas, grandpas. I had Mr. Fricky, our principal, sit in on a couple of them. And that's a huge thing for a 7-8-year-old to invite the principal to their conference. And I think whenever a student is feeling a little of those butterflies in their stomach, that's a good thing because they care about their product and they care about the result. And then selfishly, for myself, I didn't feel exhausted at the end of the night, having spent 4 hours of my time talking over the same thing. And I sent test scores home a week prior to conferences. And I told parents, too, that feel free to bring those. We can discuss anything that you want. Your child can step out of the classroom and we can have that conversation. But I think that your child is more than this MAP score, than this reading score. So I think that was really well received because I didn't have one parent. And granted, this is the first time, but want to talk about test scores. It was more about what do you really like about school? Yeah, so fabulous.
I know that you believe a lot in project-based learning. Before you tell me about any specific projects, why is PBL so critical in this day and age?
I think it's so critical because with project-based, you're tackling a real-world problem that students can see, and then they're being problem solvers throughout the whole process. And they can see that I can apply reading, math, writing, whatever topic into solving this one thing. And projects, I've noticed students are more invested in it. And kind of like student-led conferences, it has that butterfly effect where they care about the outcome. And they're usually presenting to a audience that isn't mom and dad, isn't my friends in the classroom, isn't another classroom, but it's community members, it's engineers, it's experts in the field. And another big takeaway, too, is that students, I feel like they don't even know that they're learning while they're doing, applying these things. We made this display case where we had to do, create a map, and we had to measure, and we had to figure out cost of materials. So real world. And then the Career Academy actually built this for us. So we went to our PTO, and we asked for funds to build this. Amazing.
And there's got to be something to the fact that if you're presenting to a broader audience, that you're going to want to do a better job than
Absolutely.
Perhaps just something that maybe your teacher sees.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's one of the main components of a great project is having that authentic audience where they kind of know who's going to be coming and watching them, but not really. So it kind of ups the ante, which I think that students need. Because at first, when they may be kindergartners, maybe presenting to their whole class gives them that anxious feeling that they need. But then by the time they get to second grade, they're pretty comfortable with each other, with their parents, maybe with another classroom. So what else can we do to heighten that? Because that's just like adults. You know, if I'm going to be presenting to a broader audience where I may not know who's going to be there, probably going to do a better job, put more effort into it versus at our staff meeting or at the kitchen table.
That was elementary school teacher Olivia Becker visiting with podcast host Tom Gerhart. The Cutting Ed podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public's Education Services, and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, along with philanthropist Ted Dintersmith. Dakota Datebook is next.
I like to go out dancing. My baby loves a bunch of authors.
If your idea of a perfect Saturday night is curling up with
Short Works of Fiction,
then you'll want to cast your vote for the greatest book of all time.
It's PBS's The Great American Read.
Go to pbs.org/Great American Read and browse 100 of America's best loved novels.
Catcher in the Rye, Moby Dick, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Color Purple, The Great Gatsby, 50 Shades of Grey.
Wait, what?
My tastes are very singular.
Yeah, it's on there.
All right, and so is
Vote for your favorite, then share your choice so your friends and family can join in.
Voting is open now till October 18th.
Then watch The Great American Read TV show, hosted by Meredith Vieira, starting in September. And America's choice for greatest novel will be revealed on the series finale.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 11th. The annual Miss North Dakota pageant is held in early June. It is the official preliminary contest for the Miss America pageant that takes place in early September. Although it is traditionally known as a beauty pageant, physical beauty is not the reason this contest remains relevant to young women in the 21st century. Rather, it is the substantial scholarships awarded. In fact, the state organization is formally known as the Miss North Dakota Scholarship Organization. In 2017, over $43,000 was awarded to the 19 Miss North Dakota contestants. Additionally, the national pageant claims to be the world's leading provider of scholarships to young women. The history of women's beauty pageants in the U.S. can be traced back to the 1880s. They were generally held in seaside tourist towns of the East Coast. The events were not greatly popular and even regarded as distasteful by many at the time. However, this changed with the zeitgeist of female empowerment that accompanied women winning the right to vote in 1920. Perhaps unexpectedly, the beauty pageant rose in popularity at the same time as women's social liberation. In 1921, a seaside hotel in Atlantic City, New Jersey, staged the first bathing beauty contest that would become the Miss America pageant. Held the first weekend after Labor Day, the first pageant was a ploy to keep tourists in town after the summer season. Well, the pageant was a success, and in coming years, contestants from across the country were encouraged to compete. Today, each state in the union sends a representative to compete for the crown. The first Miss North Dakota was Kitty G. Page in 1949. The first Miss North Dakota to win the Miss America title was Kara Mund in 2017. Mund grew up in Williston and since has graduated with honors from Brown University and has interned with Senator John Hoeven in Washington. The Make-A-Wish Foundation was her platform during the competition. She expressed plans to attend law school and become the first female elected governor of North Dakota. That would continue a family legacy, as Mund is related to Victoria Claffin Woodhull, the first woman to run for U.S. president, the first woman to operate a brokerage firm on Wall Street, and one of the first females to found a newspaper, Claffin and Woodhull's Weekly. Although the Miss America pageant has been met with protesters as well as supporters and fans, North Dakota's Kara Mund is a good example of the strong, confident, and community-minded individuals that the contest proclaims to support. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Maria Witham. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
To innovate, you must first start with an idea.
Anything is possible.
An engineering college in Lima designed a giant advertising billboard that absorbs air humidity and converts it into purified water.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. I'm inviting you to join me every Sunday here on Prairie Public.
In Silicon Valley, no one even takes you seriously unless you've had two failed startups. In other words, we're raising our girls to be perfect, and we're raising our boys to be brave.
Every week, we pick a theme, and we interview some of the greatest inventors, thinkers, writers, and artists from around the world.
If you analyze the skull and crossbones and Blackbeard's other design strategies like that, it's clear he was a very, very smart designer indeed.
People who've given TED Talks on technology, entertainment, and design.
If we start now, we can be ready for the next epidemic.
We examine fresh approaches to new problems, and we explore astonishing ways of thinking. Gilligan's Island. Apparently, it's one long parable. That's the TED Radio Hour, every Sunday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, on Prairie Public, with me, Guy Raz.
What can President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un really accomplish at a summit in Singapore?
The North Koreans aren't going to all of a sudden give up their weapons because of a promise from the United States. It has to be a process. It has to be confidence building.
That's one view, but there are many, even among the diplomats and other officials gathered in Singapore. Rachel Martin reports live from Singapore on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thanks for listening to this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit with Ilana Peterson. She is from North Dakota, but now lives in New York, where she founded the Double Reed Ensemble, the New York Kammermusiker, and they are about to come to North Dakota once again for their annual tour. We're also going to get some timely garden tips from Ron Smith and learn about an effort underway to add an equal rights amendment to the Minnesota Constitution. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.